Ah, the theme song from Taxi. For those of us of a certain age, the distinctive tune immediately invokes the opening credits of the late 70s, early 80s TV comedy, a simple New York yellow cab crossing the Brooklyn Bridge. And the yellow cab has long been an iconic symbol of the city, equally identifiable to New Yorkers, other Americans, and international tourists. What a casual visitor might not realize is that the foundation of these iconic vehicles is actually a very complex market. A taxi medallion is the physical certificate required to operate a yellow cab. And way back in 1937, New York City limited the number of medallions available for sale, making it a scarce commodity. And like diamonds and oceanfront property, scarcity raised the value of medallions. In 2014, a New York City taxi medallion cost about $1 million. It's a hefty sum, but for generations, the medallions were really a pretty darn good investment. So recent immigrants did what earlier generations before them have done. They faced predatory lending rates to access a medallion and entered leasing agreements to access vehicles. Hard work, long hours, commitment, they'd always ultimately been enough. But then, Uber, Lyft, and a global pandemic that halted travel. And suddenly, the value of the medallion plummeted. Once worth nearly $1 million, the New York City permit is now valued at just over $100,000. This is Queens local Augustin Tang.
I chose to inherit my father's medallion, thinking that I would inherit something that was my father's like bread and butter, and he was just so proud of owning a piece in New York. So I wanted to keep his legacy after he passed in 2015. My father was almost $530,000 in debt, and then I had to take it over, but I was just paying the bare minimum I can to bring it down.
Facing unrelenting debt with no relief in sight, last month, New York City taxi drivers began a hunger strike to pressure city officials to restructure debt. Last week, Mayor Bill de Blasio and other city officials struck a deal that ended the drivers' fast.
Under this agreement, drivers will experience real substantial debt relief. It will allow them to move forward. These drivers deserve our respect, our appreciation as all New Yorkers.
The new plan includes restructuring outstanding loans to $200,000, which would cap debt payments at around $1,100 a month. And the city will be guaranteeing all taxi driver debts. In the last relief plan, the city was not a guarantor, and some drivers would have been forced to pay up to $2,000 a month. Here to discuss the hunger strike and what was won is Bayravi Desai, the executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, the union representing the drivers. Bayravi, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
All right. Can you tell us a bit about the terms of this new deal?
Yeah. So we struck the deal with both the city and a company called Marble Gate, which is a private equity firm, and it's the largest holder of loans in the industry. The deal is that the loans will be capped at no more than $200,000, meaning no individual will have a loan balance above that amount. And you subtract from that $30,000, which is a grant from the city of New York. That's coming out of a program that the city announced about 7 months ago. And that's all they had announced back then. And so we'll now apply that grant to today's terms. So the drivers would be paying off $170,000 at about $1,122 a month. And the $170,000 will be under a city-backed guarantee, which means that if into the future they're not able to make a payment, they do lose the medallion. The bank is able to take the medallion back and resell it. If there's still a balance left on the $170,000, then the city makes up for it. So the drivers will no longer be at risk of liens on their homes or on their bank accounts. They will no longer have to file for bankruptcy. They're able to get tremendous debt relief, a payment that is affordable, and protection against liens into the future.
So as we think about this and sort of how you finally got here, I want to talk a little bit about a hunger strike as a strategy. I'm wondering where the initial impetus for that emerged.
Well, you know, this was a more than 6-year campaign for us. And particularly over the last 3 years, we've had nonstop actions. We've shut down the Brooklyn Bridge a couple of times, you know, just halted traffic. The 59th Street Bridge, you know, we've shut down the offices of banks and just engaged in a tremendous amount of direct action. We were at City Hall for a 24-hour protest. We reached over 1,000 straight hours. And so we reached the point where, you know, we'd already done all the direct action that's really imaginable. We had built tremendous political support. The entire congressional delegation had been on our side. A number of city and state electeds were on our side. We had popular support, but we still were not moving City Hall. And we needed City Hall in order to engage the lenders in a three-party negotiation. And, you know, the hunger strike was really our last effort. You know, we've done strikes in the past, never a hunger strike before. I have to tell you, in 25 years, it was the most difficult thing that I've had to announce. You don't want to see your members have to engage in a hunger strike, but we were not going to lose this fight. We were, you know, we intended on giving it absolutely everything that we had. We needed to shock the consciousness for the city and the lenders to understand our sheer determination in winning this fight.
Can you tell me how many people chose to take part? And, you know, your point about how difficult it was to even announce it, sort of what some of that lived experience was. I certainly think you're right that it reflected the clarity of how dire this situation is.
You know, we had over 70 individuals take part in the hunger strike. We had a number of not just drivers, but, you know, there were elected officials. There were members of other organizations and then just members of the public who in solidarity went on like 24-hour strikes with us. A number of us did it for the entire 15 days, some for like 13 days, 10 days. And, you know, drivers, the average age of drivers now is around 50. And a number of our hunger strikers among the drivers were in their early to mid 60s. Some had, you know, pre-existing health issues like diabetes and heart problems. A number have thyroid-related issues, so your metabolism is already really slow. We were being checked on by the New York City Docs Coalition, which is a volunteer organization. They checked on us twice a day. I myself, as the head of the union, received reports on how every hunger striker was doing. So this was an operation where, you know, we had support. This was very sensitive. This is not something that you can take on easily. There was months of planning that went behind it. People had to fill out a pre-screening health form. They had to go and have an appointment with their doctor. If they did not have medical insurance, we helped to arrange those appointments for them. And they had to really make a plan in terms of their medication, bring all the medication to the camp. We had to have medical backup ready. And, you know, I tell you, Melissa, as difficult as those 15 days were, we're now at a point of refeeding. So it's, you can't just go back to eating once you've ended a hunger strike. On average, the number of days that you've been on the strike, you cut those in half. And that's how long it's going to take your body to really adjust. For some of us, it's going to take the exact number of days that we were on hunger strike. So it's still going to be, you know, another week to 10 days before we can feel like our bodies have fully recovered.
I know that there will be some, whenever we start talking about debt relief, there are always some who will say that those who signed the loans, took out the debt, are to blame. But I want to hear for a moment again from Tang, who we heard from earlier in the segment, about being sold a dream. Let's take a listen.
they said, they sold us saying, oh, you know, invest in Medallion, invest in the city, you know, get into the middle class. You know, this is your American way, you know, American dream that you've been asking for.
Can you help us understand what he means there? What's that dream that was being sold?
So the city of New York issues the Medallion, and they sell new ones through what's called an auction. So you have to bid. It's not a lottery, you know, it's actually an auction. So you have to bid higher and higher. And the city sets what's called the opening bid. So, for example, in 2013, the opening bid was $850,000. If you had bid $849,000.99, you would have been disqualified from that auction. Through the years, the city issues reports on the value of the Medallion, and a New York Times investigation found that they had fudged many of those reports. They inflated the value when they publicized it, sometimes as much as by 11%. And the city allowed in financial institutions that were not allowed to loan after the housing market crash. They were still allowed to loan to the drivers. And so this was a real act of fraud by the city, and in hand with a number of financial institutions and industry players that engaged in, you know, in inflating the value. Many of those same city officials then allowed in Uber and Lyft without regulation. So by 2014, you had over 45,000 Uber and Lyft cars. By 2018, you had over 85,000 Uber and Lyft cars versus about 10,000 yellow cabs that were operational. And many of those same individuals, by the way, then went to work directly for Uber and Lyft. So this was a real, you know, this was to us a real criminal conspiracy, you know, has not been prosecuted as such. At the very bare minimum, it was incredibly immoral. And it set this crisis, which, you know, not only has led to financial ruin of thousands of drivers and their families, but there were 9 driver suicides throughout this tragedy.
So do drivers have a fighting chance of survival given the realities of rideshare apps?
Well, I think bringing down the debt to these numbers, yes, in the immediate timing gives drivers that chance of survival. There is still so much more to be done. You know, the despair that drivers as an entire workforce have faced, whether they be yellow cab drivers or Uber and Lyft drivers themselves, is that full-time driving has really been destroyed by the Uber and Lyft business model. You know, it's a business model that is out to eradicate, you know, full-time work. They believe, you know, they call it gig work, which is all about part-timing a full-time job. It's reducing the income, and you justify that reduction by saying this is only a gig. It's not meant to be a job. And that's been the heart of the despair. And they've done it by saturating the streets with vehicles. So, you know, yellow cabs get drowned out. Uber and Lyft drivers end up being placed in the back of the line for a dispatch because there's so many new people coming in. This is a moment for reset. It's a reset on protecting full-time work. It's a reset on how we address issues of transit justice for the public and for the consumer base, especially around race-based refusals and around the rights of our customers who have disabilities. It's a moment to reset the economics where the workers are placed at the center and not the companies or the banks. So there's a lot of work to be done, but this for us was the fundamental fight that would allow us to have that new day.
Bhairavi Desai is the executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. Thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.